It's time to go back to school with Professor Fish, Southern Colorado's only show dedicated to college athletics, University of Fish.
Oh, man, I think the clock is slow.
Class is now in session.
I don't feel tardy.
Here's the professor, Tim Fisher.
Welcome to the University of Fish. I am the professor, Tim Fisher, and let me tell you what we got on tap for you today. We're going to talk some College World Series, have to do that. We're almost to the Championship Series. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But after that, we're going to talk about background checks in NCAA recruiting. We had the whole deal with Luke Heimlich, who came out from Oregon State. We found out about his checkered past, about making family ties a little too close when he was 15 and his cousin was only 6. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about transgenders in college sports. Yes, it's a strange subject, and trust me, it really is a strange subject. We'll be talking with Derek Wilburn from Allenby West about that, and then we'll also talk a little crime and punishment. Lincoln Riley's only been on the post at Oklahoma for a couple weeks, but already has a player in trouble to deal with. He got a big raise, but he has to deal with the player in trouble, and we'll talk a little bit about that and what Coach K thinks about the whole one and done in college basketball. But we're going to start off talking College World Series because that is the ultimate sport going on right now. It's the penultimate because it's the last championship for the spring season for the NCAAs. And we'll be joined by, and we are joined right now by actually, Matt Martell. You may remember him from talking about the Penn State spring game. He's a student writer for the Penn State paper, but he also works for MLB.com. So the guy knows his baseball. How you doing this morning, Matt?
Good, Tim. How are you doing?
Just fine. Well, we had a good day. We've had a good week of baseball in Omaha. It's been a home run fest. Every team just knocking them out of the park. Yesterday, we had a matchup, which was the second game we saw in the College World Series, LSU and Oregon State, like we just talked about. Oregon State without Luke Heimlich. But that first game against LSU, you'd think he was pitching because Heimlich had a .76 ERA and Oregon State just jumped all over LSU. So when they matched up again yesterday, you really thought it could be another Beaver blowout, but it wasn't. LSU came back. What did you see in the LSU-Oregon State game from yesterday?
Well, I saw a tight game with good pitching, and I saw that it wasn't a blowout. And I think that was a big thing. I mean, after the first game, everybody was like, Oregon State's going to run away with this game. They could even run away with the whole tournament, especially in the next round. But what I saw was very, very good pitching from Alex Lang of LSU.
And, okay, do you think that first game, LSU, you know, we had just experienced the MLB draft. Three signees that LSU had coming in did get drafted. Some LSU players got drafted. Was it kind of a draft hangover possibly?
It could have been, and I think it's hard to say that it's a draft hangover because these guys are still getting the chance to play in the College World Series, but I think that there is a fatigue aspect of going through the, I don't know if it's pressures, but it's a whirlwind of an experience for these guys. I had a few friends I know get drafted this year, and they told me that it's kind of like an experience they don't want to get too wrapped up in. Because it's tiring, because you think so much about it. So, yeah, I think that's a good thought that, you know, there could have been a draft hangover because, you know, it's just a crazy experience for them.
And then on the other side of the bracket right now, who we'll see match up again today, we'll talk about today's matchups in just a second, but TCU, if there is a Cinderella left in the College World Series, it's got to be the Horned Frogs out of the Big 12. They played Florida yesterday and put it on Florida, a 9-2 winner. It was a late game last night. I know you had some MLB stuff that you had to do as well, but were you able to catch any of this game or know what was going on in this game? Because it was a great game, and the Horned Frogs.
Yeah, no, it was a great game. I did watch some of it because the Yanks were in a rain delay for the first hour and 40 minutes they were supposed to be in a rain delay. So I caught the beginning of it, and what I was really impressed with was the Horned Frogs. I mean, they were the number one ranked team in college baseball heading into the series. I know this because they played Penn State to open up the year, and it didn't look good for Penn State, but that's not the point. But TCU is a really good program. They're always at the top. And, yeah, they're the sixth-ranked team against, you know, Florida, who's a powerhouse as well. But I wouldn't be surprised if TCU took it tonight either.
So we're already getting an early prediction from you. We hadn't even talked about the first game it's going to be today, and that's going to be LSU and Oregon State, the third time in the College World Series. but TCU, I talked with Mac Engel of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram last week, and he's going, you know, TCU's had a great season. I just don't know how much they're going to be able to do in the College World Series. And I'd almost love to have Mac on again this week just to say, hey, look, the Horned Frogs are actually playing really well. But the Horned Frogs are playing well, representing the Big 12 well. I mean, the Big 12 was a great conference this year in college baseball because Baylor did very well. Texas is always a strong team. Oklahoma State and Oklahoma both were in the mix to get to Super Regionals, didn't make it there. But, I mean, it was overall a great year for the Big 12, and I think TCU is representing them very well. So you kind of think TCU may take Florida tonight?
Yeah, they definitely can, and I would not be surprised if they do. They have the experience being a team that's, you know, been around for a while in the College World Series. And at this point, I don't know how much the seeding means something. I know it means that they were the better, you know, teams were better during the regular season and heading into the tournament itself. But TCU's experienced team. They're a good team. I've seen them play because I had to watch them at the beginning of the year. And I think they're too strong of a team to go down in a blowout to Florida or to let Florida walk all over them.
Okay.
So I really do think they're too strong of a team.
Well, now, this isn't college softball, so you're not going to have Lang out on the mound again for LSU today. You might see him in some short relief if he had to go. But looking at the matchup between LSU and Oregon State, and before all the games started last Saturday, I said that I thought it was going to come down between LSU and Oregon State, whoever won that side of the bracket. And it still could come down to that. Who do you think is going to take the LSU-Oregon State matchup?
That's a tough one because I think Oregon State is the best team in college baseball. But the best team in college baseball doesn't win the College World Series. The last time, or since they switched to the new format, Miami was the only team that won it. And that was in the first year of switching. Miami was the only top seed to win the tournament since they switched to the new format. So it doesn't happen all the time. And if you're saying whichever team comes out of this side of the bracket wins the tournament, maybe it's not Oregon State.
I mean, I've really liked LSU all season long, and I've liked them. I've liked what they did in the Super Regional. They looked great. And they looked good in the LSU Regional before that as well. And so I really see, I know you're seeing a TCU floor. TCU sounds like possibly LSU matchup for the championship series. I'm thinking a Florida LSU is what I'm thinking for that. And so if we have a match, okay, let's go with your matchup. TCU, LSU, who wins the championship series?
LSU. If LSU beats Oregon State, they're going to ride it through.
Okay, so you're saying Oregon State would be the vulnerable team on that side of the bracket.
On that side of the bracket, yeah, but I also think that I agree with you that whoever wins on that side of the bracket is the better team and would win.
Well, we will know this next week. I mean, next week when we go to the air, we'll have a champion in the College World Series. Matt Martell, I know you've got to get out to the stadium for baseball today. I know people will be watching the College World Series. I want to thank you for coming on the University of Fish, and we'll be right back after this break.
Everyone, back in your seats. University of Fish is back in session.
Welcome back to the University of Fish. We are joined now by Lindsay Sadlowski, an attorney, but when she was in college, granted it was law school, when she was in college, she wrote an article. I don't know if you could call this an article because it's almost like a book, checking up on student athletes, an NCAA regulation requiring criminal background checks. Now, this was a big news last week because of the Luke Heimlich story out of Oregon State, who failed to report as a sexual offender when he got to Corvallis. And then, luckily, students, and we love students here at the University of Fish, decided to do background checks. The student paper did background checks on all the Division I players at the school and found out that he was a registered sex offender because when he was 15 years old, multiple times raped a six-year-old relative. And this would have been found out had background checks for recruits been a requirement. Now, Lindsay Sadlowski, welcome to the University of Fish. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Sorry to bring you in on such a sour note with the Oregon State story, but like I said, you wrote pretty much a book on this, on what has happened and what could have been averted if we hadn't, if we did have systematic background checks of college athletes. Because it gets into just more than, okay, hey, they were kids when this happened. They're going to, you know, they've turned their lives around. It's not just that, because we could get into a legal question here. But first off, tell us about your checking up on student athletes, the whole big thing that you wrote. Give us a quick background on that and what led you to write this.
Sure. So this was more than 10 years ago that I wrote this article, and have been a practicing attorney since then. So when I wrote this article, I was at the Marquette Sports Law Program, one of the best sports law programs in the country. And, you know, I was a student athlete myself, and so I was interested in this issue. A lot of stories coming out at that time about violence of student athletes on campus. There were, like, shooting deaths. There was a Wisconsin issue. Wisconsin football players had sexually assaulted some women. Just a lot of stories coming out. I think right after this article came out, the Duke lacrosse issue came out, which obviously is a different situation now that we've learned all the details. But that's kind of where this came from. And just a quick background on where this goes is, you know, with all this violence and all the competitiveness is correlated with violence. So student athletes have a high rate of violence because they are highly competitive. And the more competitive they are, the more likely they are to engage in violence. And a lot of research has shown that. And so this is an article that calls for the NCAA to take action, you know, with a bylaw, some sort of regulation requiring background checks on student athletes before they come into the university, calling for more university accountability as well.
Now, when you did this, you cited a study from 1978 to 1998, which seems like forever ago, because it really was these days. That's almost 20 years ago, where 175 athletes were arrested for criminal activity at the Division I level. Now, sadly enough, doing my research to talk to you, I looked up how many had been arrested recently in recent years. And from 2010 to 2015, there were almost an arrest every other day. There were 900-plus arrests just for football teams in 5 years. And that's really disturbing because, you know, sports should be a release, and it is a release for a lot of people because there is a, you know, and like you said, the competitiveness of these people, you know, they have that built-up anger, that built-up competitiveness, and it sometimes correlates into a really bad thing. But do we get into an area to where a university could be liable for bringing one of these kids that has a storied checkered past onto their campus to where, you know, because like I'm sure that, you know, we'll see in the coming years the whole Baylor debacle that's been going on, that some of these people bring up civil suits against the university because of putting them in harm's way because of bringing these people on campus. Is there going to be
Go ahead.
No, is there going to be a question of liability there?
Absolutely. I believe that there will be because, I mean, student athletes are placed in a position of leadership. They're placed in a position of representing the universities. They have power on campus that other student athletes or other students don't have. And, you know, the universities are, I mean, especially in the big sports, basketball and football, but I can say this for all sports. I mean, myself, I was an average student athlete, I was a great student. But, I mean, even at that level, I appreciate that the student athletes had a great deal of respect and power on campus that other students didn't have. And so I think they're bringing these student athletes in, and, you know, being a student athlete is a privilege, not a right. And so I think the universities do have accountability for these athletes that they bring in, and they're putting them, you know, in front of young kids who are, you know, at camps and at signings and at different levels where their athletes need to be trusted, and they're bringing them into this position of power. So, yeah, whether it's a claim of negligence, I know in my article I had cited that there was a potential claim for negligent recruiting. I don't know that that has been really fleshed out in the cases at this point. At 10 years ago it hadn't been, and I haven't followed up on that, but I don't believe it has been at this point either. But certainly the universities could be in a position of liability, civil liability for bringing these student athletes on onto campus without understanding and taking, you know, measures to reduce the risk to other students, to other athletes, to coaches, to, you know, anybody coming on campus.
Now, I understand, and I hate to be able to understand this, but I understand why a lot of these kids do slip through the cracks and they're not reported. Because your high school coach is going to know everything that's gone on during your high school days. We all know that. If anybody that's ever played high school sports knows that your coach knows exactly what you're doing all the time. And a lot of times why they don't tell these recruiters what's going on, because the more Division I athletes you get recruited out of your program, the better chance you have as a coach to move up to get that big college job. And I think that's where a lot of this could be happening. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. And I think that it's important for the NCAA to take some action, because for the individual colleges to do it on their own at this point, it does put them at a disadvantage in recruiting and in bringing in the top athletes, where, you know, a sister program or somebody else in their conference isn't running the background checks, and they're bringing in these athletes without asking those questions. I mean, it does put you at a competitive disadvantage. So I think it needs to start at the higher level, the NCAA, to put everybody on the same playing field.
Now, when we look at the statistics, which are mind-boggling as it is, I mean, we don't have a hard number on how many of these people had juvenile records and everything, because of juvenile records being sealed and everything. But we do know that athletes do, especially when you get into your more physical sports, your football, your basketball, your lacrosse, hockey, the ones that were, you know, require more physicality and more one-on-one combat almost, that's where you see the most arrest. I mean, because just from last year, we had 203 college football players, this is just Division I, that were either charged, cited, or got arrested. We have 58 basketball players that did, 12 coaches. And then, granted, when you start looking at, like, college baseball, that drops down because it's not as a physical a sport. There are only four there. But, you know, you can't say, oh, there's only four. Four is too many. I mean, one is too many when it gets to situations like this. What do you recommend as a solution to this?
So my recommendation for a solution was, you know, the NCAA has to take action requiring criminal background checks at the Division I level, and I think it has to focus on, you know, the violent felonies like sexual assault, battery, aggravated assault, Obviously, you know, things like murder would be really important. But, I mean, there are inconsistencies, like you mentioned, in what's available state by state on juvenile records. Some states make the juvenile records more available. Some aren't available. There are situations where these violent felonies become charged in the adult system, especially, you know, when a juvenile is, you know, 16, 17, these go into the adult system. And I just think that you have to do these checks. And, I mean, it may not find everything that's out there, but if it's out there and it's publicly available, I don't think that the universities can still continue to have plausible deniability for their athletes not knowing what their background is. And because with this knowledge, it doesn't mean that the athlete has to be denied an opportunity to be on campus. I mean, some situations you may say, like, this isn't a good fit, but they have to be able to take preventative measures, such as, you know, a sexual assault crime. You don't want that athlete being with young students or young children at a camp. You need to take preventative measures, and without that knowledge, you can't take those preventative measures. But I don't think the NCAA has to go so far as to say, you know, if they have a violent felony, they cannot participate in athletics at the Division I level. I think the universities can take that step if they want to, but I think they at least need to have the background checks and understand what the athlete's criminal background looks like coming in to the extent possible.
Exactly. And you do, because you, like you said, you can't just say, well, okay, you can't come on campus, you can't come to school here, because people do rehabilitate. We know that.
Absolutely.
And because one of the examples that you showed in your article was because, and we didn't really know what he was going to do later in life at this point in time, but Randy Moss has turned his life around from the early problems he had. But for every Randy Moss, there's also a Lawrence Phillips, who you also cited in this article. Lawrence Phillips, who did pass away in prison because of other crimes he committed after he committed the crimes on campus. And so, you know, you have both sides of the coin there. But I do have to agree with you. You have to get stricter about looking into these backgrounds, because, I mean, I have been the biggest Joe Mixon defender for years now, because what he did was a heat of the passion thing. He just took one punch. It wasn't a sexual assault that takes conscious thought. But then you look further back, you know, there were allegations that he did it in high school as well. So, and you would have known that before, whether it was actually true or not, because the whole thing got debunked. But you would have known there was an allegation before, had there been a background check into Joe Mixon before he came onto the campus there in Norman, Oklahoma. And so, you know, I do understand the whole need for that. And, Lindsay, I know your time is short, and I know we're getting short on time here. So I want to thank you for coming on the University of Fish. But before I let you go, I need you to introduce yourself, tell us who you are, what you do, and say you're listening to the University of Fish.
My name is Lindsay Sadlowski. I am an attorney, and I practice general business law and labor and employment law, and I'm associated with the law firm of Sadlowski and Best in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I am listening to the University of Fish.
Thank you, ma'am, and hey, you're going to love Joe Mixon there at Cincinnati. Coaches are already saying how great he is.
We're looking forward to it, and obviously keeping a pretty close eye on it as well.
Yeah, well, I see. Full disclosure, I am a OU alum. So
okay.
Yeah, and so and granted, when you look at the top 25 programs for arrests over that 2010-2015, Oklahoma sitting at number 5. Yay.
Well, the Cincinnati Bengals have had their share of
interesting
characters on the team. So I'm thinking positive that this will be a good situation for
us. And he did everything he was asked to do, and he's rehabilitated himself, and I've met the kid. He's a good kid. But anyway, thank you for coming on today, ma'am, and I do appreciate it.
I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
We're going to take a break, but we're going to come right back with more University of Fish right here on Extra Sports 1300.
Everyone, back in your seats. Professor Fish is giving a lecture.
Welcome back to the University of Fish. I am the Professor Tim Fisher. We are now joined by Derek Wilburn. If you know that name, he is a big name locally. He's the head of Rocky Mountain Black Conservatives. He is also an author who has published on Alan West. Derek, how you doing this morning?
I am absolutely outstanding. And I'm not just a big name locally, bro. I'm known throughout the known civilized world.
That is true. I'm sorry to belittle your accomplishments there.
But yeah, anyway. I'm big in Sweden. I'm big in Germany, Scandinavia, all those places.
And they do love their Derek Wilburn all over the globe. But right now we're talking to him because you wrote an article about a Connecticut high school, I want to say boy, but we'll vet that out here in a minute. But he decides that he identifies as a female and then competes in the state track and field finals. You take it from there. Tell us about this young man or girl or whatever.
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting that you say that, because if you pay attention to mainstream or more liberal media outlets, they always use female adjectives to describe transgenders. So you're anatomically, biologically a male, but they always will use she and her and adjectives like that to describe these people. It's very curious, but this is a young man who is identifying as a female, apparently, and competed in the Connecticut State High School track and field state meet, which, of course, you know, is near and dear to my house, my heart. My kids are runners. My son is a recruited athlete. He runs for the United States Air Force Academy, and I'm big on track and field. Well, he wins, of course, because he's a male, and sends the competition packing. Interestingly, the time in which he won the 100-meter and the 200-meter dash, both of those times would have placed him in last place had he competed with the men. So he isn't even all that fast, but he's faster than all the girls, and so he takes home the trophies, and the girl that would have won takes a silver, and the girl that would have taken a silver, of course, takes the bronze, and so on and so forth.
Well, now, correct me if I'm wrong. He is a freshman boy, he's a freshman. We'll just go with that. He is a ninth grade athlete. That's probably the easiest way to say it. And the girl, who is actually a girl, is a sophomore that he beat in both the 100 and the 200. So she's looking at the next 2-3 years of going up against this person. I'm going to try to use non-gender specifics on this. And so unless she gets appreciably faster, her track and field career, yes, it might be good, but she'll never be a champion because this person will always be faster.
You're correct and you're incorrect. So you can't say she'll never be a champion because she was the champion last year. She won both the 100 and the 200 as a freshman. Now this gender-confused, gender-identifying individual is a freshman, is younger than she. So, yeah, she will be running up against this person for the next 3 years of her career, meaning the chances of her ever taking home another blue ribbon are probably slim and none, and slim has left the building. Now, and I've written on Alan about a couple of other similar cases. This happened in Hawaii with a volleyball player. This happened down under in New Zealand with a weightlifter. Men who identify as women just crushing the competition and standing on top of the podium and accepting their trophy. And it causes one to wonder about liberals who claim to be the ones that are in favor of women's rights and supportive of empowering women, but at the same time are promoting and supportive of men identifying as women and taking women's accomplishments, their trophies, their recognition could the day come where one day all athletic records are held by men?
It seems like it could be trending that way. Now, my question is about this young person, once again trying to stay as non-gender specific as possible. Have they done anything to transform themselves or to transition into the female role?
No. From what I could tell in researching this individual, there is no hormone therapy taking place. We're not in the throes of actually becoming a female. And even for people who do those things, like the other two individuals I cited, in my mind, in my eye, and I think probably a lot of your listeners, unless and until you actually undergo gender reassignment surgery, so you go under some sort of a knife and actually become the other gender, that's going to be a tough one. So, I mean, look at it this way. This individual in Hawaii, where volleyball is the biggest sport in Hawaii by far, and this individual, he/she, is tearing it up, just dominating the women, because men can jump higher, are more muscular, for obvious reasons. Well, the team that he/she is playing on has just him. What happens if one day, but volleyball is played 6-on-6, instead of just having one transgender athlete, you have all six? Then what do you do?
That does create quite a, for lack of a better term, and not talking anatomically here, that creates quite a pickle for the situation there. And then you have situations like there's a professor, I'm trying to pull it up right now, of where he was. He asked the question on a final exam, it was an essay question, asking about should males who identify as female be able to compete in collegiate sports with the girls. And he caught all kinds of flack for this. And it was at, a California college. It was College of the Desert. The final question was, during track and field season, Palm Springs High School had a boy who thinks he's a girl competing against girls in track and field. Since boys are physically more muscular, bigger, stronger, and faster, how is this a fair competition? What is the point in even having girl sports if this is going to be allowed? What should competitors themselves, their parents, and their coaches do about this? And the campus was in an uproar because he asked this question. But then, because as we saw in Connecticut, the young girl that came in second and presumably will do as well her junior and senior years, she was scared to talk about it, wasn't she?
Yeah, well, and therein lies the conundrum. So if you mention it, talk about it, complain about it, you're a bigot. If you don't, then all of the time, effort, energy, and discipline you've put into training, conditioning your body, getting better at whatever the sport is that you're competing in, all that is for naught because you're never going to win. This individual in New Zealand who won the weightlifting competition, I mean, he won by something like 45 combined kilos in a three-lift competition, deadlift, bench press, squat, whatever it is. Just destroyed it. I mean, no woman could possibly overcome a 40-kilogram deficit. It's just not going to happen. You're never going to win. But if you say something, you're a bigot.
And since you went all metric on us, so if those of you who don't understand your metric conversions, that's roughly 100 pounds difference, because a kilo is 2.2 pounds. We all know that. Well, those in the drug trade know that at least. But my question is, when it gets to college sports, I mean, I could never hit a curveball in junior high or high school, but I could smack the hell out of a softball. What stops me from identifying as a woman and walking on to, I couldn't probably walk onto the Oklahoma squad because it's the best squad in the nation, but, to a smaller school and being a softball star as a guy? I mean, I want to joke and say we saw it with Brittany Griner at Baylor, but yes, she is a female. She just has more facial hair than I have. But there's nothing stopping that right now in any of the NCAA bylaws, or there's no, because everybody's so scared of what's going to happen if they offend 2.7% of the population in the country. What's going to stop it in colleges?
It's the tail wagging the dog. It's the most incredible thing. So I don't know what's going to stop it in the colleges, the answer to your question, because colleges, as you know, as we all know, are dominated by liberal thought. It's tough to find a conservative college professor anywhere anymore. That's just the direction that thing has gone. And, you know, we all remember, at least those of us who are over 35 maybe, we remember it wasn't that long ago that the Russian and Czechoslovakian female Olympians were being castrated and castigated and run off the farm because it was found that they were using performance enhancing drugs. They were using testosterone and boosters. They were using steroids. And they had facial hair and deep voices. And I remember listening to some of the female swimmers from the USA saying, I heard them talking. I thought there was men in the locker room. So the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, they got busy, got together a set of rules and started banning it because it wasn't fair. Well, now we're going to let people whose bodies naturally manufacture testosterone, they have to even take it, compete and say that that is fair. It's the most backwards and upside down situation that you'll ever see.
And I want to say, you know what, here's the solution. I mean, but other than, you know, because everybody applauded, you know, people like Katie Nida, even though I hate what happened to her when she was at Colorado, but everybody applauded her for going out and playing football because there was not a female football team. So you had those instances where if the sport was not offered for their sex, they would go play it and for the guys. And just last year, everybody knows that listens to me very often knows I do news as well and also work with Richard Randall. His daughter actually got to play with the guys' JV team last year at Cheyenne Mountain High School. But it's not like his son was trying to go play softball. I understand a girl playing a guy sport. I do, especially if they're that dominant. But you flip the coin over, and it's just wrong.
It is, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see how the liberal movement in the country and in the world ultimately resolves this. So what you have in liberalism, if you have a lot of blatant hypocrisies or a lot of situations where they're trying to have it both ways, and this is one of them. You know, we're in favor of women's rights, but we're not defending women losing to men if those men say that they're women. Well, how does that work? So they're going to have to come up with a way to make this happen. And I'm very interested to see what they're going to do. Because on the one hand, if you say, sorry, you're not competing with females because you are not a biological female, then they're going to be calling themselves what they call us, a bunch of bigots and haters. But on the other hand, if they do allow the competition, then you're saying to women, sorry, we claim to care about your rights, but when push comes to shove, we're more concerned with political correctness than with standing up for you. It's a very interesting pickle. Can't believe you went there. And how it all plays out, I have no idea. But it's very, very fascinating.
It pretty much throws Title IX out the window in NCAA athletics. It really does. I mean, because they wanted to make everything so equal. And I guess what you start having to do, I mean, I would hate to have to put quotas of the male teams have to have so many female. It'd be like co-ed softball or almost. Because I talked to a young lady that I work with here at the station. She played college lacrosse. And I said, hey, so what if a guy came out and played lacrosse with you? And she said, Tim, you know, that's not really a good comparison because you're not able to hit the way you can in men's lacrosse, in girls' lacrosse. You can't be as physical. She's going, but if it ever happened on a basketball court, it's completely wrong. And this was a college athlete talking about this. And like we both said, I really don't see a solution other than to whatever you were born. You know, if you got something hanging, you're on the guy's team. If you don't have anything hanging, you're on the girl's team. That's the only solution I see.
It'd be interesting to see if that is the only solution. I don't know. It's pretty easy for you and I. But yeah. Then you and I aren't presidents, provosts, or athletic directors at these bastions of liberalism that have become United States colleges and universities.
Well, I've long wondered about the Connecticut basketball team with some of the people they've had on there on the girls' team. That's just a joke, but their dominance has ended. But I want Derek. We could talk for hours and not come up with a solution. So I want to thank you for your time because I don't know where we go from here.
No, nor does anybody else. There's only one way to find out, and that's to get on board, ride the train to the end of the line, and see where it ends. So always a pleasure, man. Let me know whenever you want to talk. I'm here for you.
That was Derek Wilburn, author from Allen West, and as we learned from him firsthand, renowned worldwide. Derek Wilburn, thanks for coming on University of Fish.
We're going to take a break, but we're going to come right back with more University of Fish right here on Extra Sports 1300.
Let's take a step out on the quad. Professor Fish is giving a lecture.
Welcome back to the University of Fish. I am the professor, Tim Fisher, and you know we've talked about background checks on players. We've talked about the College World Series. We've talked about transgenders in sports. So where do we go from there? Well, let's go to the NBA draft. Well, not the draft, just kind of about the draft and the plague of the one and dones. You saw it all up and down the first round of these one-year players going to play school for one semester. They're eligible for the second semester so they can play basketball, and that's all they go to school. They go for a free ride for 1 year. In the case of Louisville, get hookers along the way, and then they're gone. But what do we do about that? Coach K, of course, Mike Tucheski of Duke, has an idea. Why not go back to the day where kids can go straight from high school into the pros? It worked for Kobe Bryant. It worked for Kevin Garnett. It worked for Moses Malone and Daryl Dawkins, if you want to go back further than that. But what if, as Coach K says, if they do commit to going to school, keeping them for 2 years, make them commit to actually going to class for more than one semester? Yeah, they'll only have to go to three if they're going for 2 years. But anyway, they would still be getting an education. If they do it like Major League Baseball, yes, you can be drafted right out of high school. But if you do commit to a college, you have to play 3 years of college ball before you can go to the pros. In college football, you have to be 3 years removed from your high school senior year before you can enter the NFL draft. Why do we give them a pass in basketball? I hate the one and dones. You see no more senior-laden teams where you say, wow, that team was a dynasty for 4 years. Yeah, the same team, like a Kentucky, might be good year after year after year, but it's always a different cast of characters. You're even seeing it at Kansas more often than not now. These one-and-dones come in. Yes, you had people that do stick around for 3 or 4 years, but it's not the same cohesiveness that you're going to see in a team that has played together for 4 years. Anyway, so enough of that, enough of the one-and-dones. Lonzo Ball, you got your wish. Well, you got your daddy's wish. You're an L.A. Laker now. You had to go to school for 1 year, well, one semester at UCLA, and now you're on to the NBA, so congratulations. You know, and I'm not coming down on all the one-and-dones. Yeah, I understand some of these kids come from broken homes or from underprivileged areas. I understand that. But if you're going to commit to going to school, go to school. Now, let's talk a little recruiting. Big day for the Oklahoma Sooners in recruiting yesterday, but we're not going to talk about that. We'll talk about the Sooners in a second. You know I can't go a show without doing it. Let's talk about the Fighting Illini. Bunchy Young, a 10-year-old, was offered a scholarship to play football at Illinois. Granted, the Illinois program has been in shambles for years. They don't know what to do in Champaign up there. They have not had a good team in years. Ron Zook tried to do something, but he did nothing, just like he did when he was at Florida. But giving a 10-year-old, seriously, a 10-year-old, going, hey, we want you to come play football here in 8 years when you're old enough. You don't know how that kid's going to develop. Yes, it's a publicity stunt. It's a ploy. And, you know, this Bunchy Miller kid or Bunchy Young kid may turn out to be a great player in 8 years when he's old enough. Now back to Oklahoma. I said I was going to bring it up, and I have to bring it up. Lincoln Riley, of course, has been the new head coach for, two and a half weeks. He was making $1.3 million as an assistant. So he got the head job. What'd they do? All they did was put the three in front of the decimal point and the one after it. So a rookie head coach making $3.1 million in his first year as a head coach. Now, he's already had to earn it. Already had to earn it because, when you take a big program like that, you're going to have problems. You're going to have things that happen that you have to take care of. And, well, he'd barely been head coach for a week, week and a half, and then some idiot comes along and has to spoil everything. Of course, I'm talking about Will Sunderland, the Oklahoma safety, who was suspended by the Sooners indefinitely. This kid's gone in Norman, I'll tell you that right now, after he was charged with felony burglary. Now, when this case first came about, he said that he was, set up. He was that the friends were storing the stolen goods at his place. So he was first arrested for concealing stolen property. Then it turns out he was going in the athletic dorms, stealing game consoles, Xbox Ones, PS4s, Nintendo Next, whatever you have. And he was stealing them and then taking them to Oklahoma City to sell at a pawn shop. I'm sorry, no program needs someone like that around. You're out of here. I mean, it's going to be Lincoln Riley's first person to kick off the team, but he's going to have to do it because you cannot trust that kid in your locker room whatsoever. Speaking of kids in locker rooms, Keyshawn Johnson. We all know Keyshawn Johnson. Just throw me the damn ball, right? Remember him with the New York Jets, played with some with the Cowboys, some with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Great receiver at USC. His son, a great receiver in his own right, has been at Nebraska for 6 months. Early enrollee there at Nebraska. He's going to be a freshman this year. Gets caught with pot and paraphernalia in his dorm room there in Nebraska. So what's Daddy Keyshawn do? Comes, grabs the kid by the back of the neck, jerks him off the team. He is, according to Keyshawn Sr., suspended indefinitely, or for right now. Because Keyshawn Sr. said, you're not going to embarrass Nebraska like that. You're not going to embarrass college football like that. You're not going to embarrass our family like that. That is some good parenting. I never really liked Keyshawn Johnson, but I got to give it up to him there. Great job of parenting there by Keyshawn Johnson. Now, my only question is the title of his next book, Keyshawn's book, of course he had, Just Throw Me the Damn Ball, is the next book going to be Just Pass Me the Damn Bong? There's a question to leave you with. I am the professor. Coming up next, the other football show right here on Extra Sports 1300. Next week, we start our Heisman flashbacks as we count down 10 weeks until college football. We'll have 10 Heisman flashbacks for you throughout the next 10 weeks leading up to the kickoff of college football season. I'm the professor, Tim Fisher. We'll see you next week right here on Extra Sports 1300.